dilemmas for Christians today is how do we get people to want to listen to the Christian message? How do we get people to stop and listen to the Christian gospel? Now, CMS Summer School was 2 weeks ago. It's all about missionaries. And one of the common motifs we heard from various missionaries who are reaching out to Muslim people is that Muslims will sometimes, from time to time, have dreams that will cause them to seek out a local Christian. So one common example is that they will have a dream of a man dressed in white, and this man dressed in white will do something that will spark the Muslim to say, look, I need to find myself a Christian to help me interpret this dream, because this is not a Muslim dream that I'm having. And so for some Muslims, it's a dream or a vision that compels them to stop and wants to look into the gospel. Now, it's not until they look into the gospel that they may actually convert, but we need to, how do we get them to actually stop and look into the gospel? So for us, we have some Muslims around here, but mostly we've just got your regular Aussie secular person. How do we get the regular Westerners to want to look into God's word? Well, arguably, the most powerful tool for this is when Christians show Christ-like love, like we saw in Ruth 1. When Christians show Christ-like kindness, like we saw in Ruth 2, and when Christians show Christ-like redemption, like we're going to see today in Ruth chapter 3. You see, when non-Christians see, witness the kind of disciples that Jesus makes, it makes them want to look into Jesus for themselves. So now, I've used this illustration before, so please forgive me, but it really demonstrates this wonderfully. It's the true story of a 26, 27-year-old woman who walks into church one day, and the minister goes up and says, greets her and says, hi, how are you? Why are you here? What brings you to church today? And the woman said to the minister, I have just made a career-ending mistake. I should have been fired on the spot for what I did, but my boss stepped in and took the blame for me. And in doing so, he took a real hit for his promising career. And she said, now look, I've had plenty of managers take credit for my work before, but never once have I had a manager step in and take the blame for my mistakes. And so I went into my manager and I said, what is going on? What made you do this? Why would you do such a thing for me? And my manager said, oh look, you're a good kid, and I didn't want your career to go down the toilet so early in life. And she said, nope, that's not it. What's the real reason? And my manager said, look, the real reason is that I'm a Christian. And Jesus, being a Christian, means that Jesus took all my mistakes, all my sin away. And so I want to spend the rest of my life passing that same gift, that same grace onto others. And so the young lady said to her boss, which church do you go to? When non-Christians see the kind of disciples that Jesus makes, it makes them want to look into Jesus. But here's the thing. That manager didn't do what he did so that the young woman would become a Christian. He was actually a little cagey about his faith to begin with. The reason the manager did that was simply because he's a Christian. You see, showing Christ-like redemption, taking on someone's mistakes or debts, it's actually not an evangelism tool, though it has a great outcome in that area often. It is simply part of the Christian life. In Galatians 6, verse 2, Paul says, carry each other's burdens, and this way you will fulfill the law of Christ. Carry each other's burdens. But here's the thing, that's really hard to do, isn't it? It's really hard to carry other people's burdens. So the question we have today is, how on earth do we become that kind of Christian? How on earth do we become the kind of Christian who will gladly take on other people's debts, other people's problems, and redeem them from their situation? Well, that's what Ruth chapter 3 is going to show us this morning. So last week, we saw Ruth being shown incredible kindness, Christ-like kindness, by Boaz. Boaz is a member of her deceased husband's family. But in this week's passage, in Ruth chapter 3, Boaz goes way beyond that. We see even more of his incredible character in today's passage. In Ruth chapter 3, Boaz doesn't just give up some grain and some water to Ruth. He gives up almost everything. He gives up his marriage. He gives up his kids. He gives up his estate, as we're going to see today. And so our job today is to figure out how he does this. What makes Boaz show redemption beyond measure in this passage? And I've got 3 points that you can see on your sermon outline. So we're going to begin by looking at Ruth, who is a woman in need. We're then going to look at Boaz, who is Ruth's immediate redeemer, all right, the immediate redeemer. But there's a third person that this passage points to, and it's this third person that actually causes Boaz to do what he does, and that third person is the real redeemer, all right? So a woman in need, the immediate redeemer, and the real redeemer. So let's begin. We pick it up in chapter 3, verse 1. One day, Ruth's mother-in-law, Naomi, said to her, "My daughter, I must find a home for you where you'll be well provided for." So Ruth's plight, if you recall from last week, is that she is firstly dirt poor, okay? She had to glean behind the harvesters just to eat. Secondly, she's a woman, which would mean that she would be in very grave danger of being harmed while she's out in the field alone gleaning. And third, she's a foreigner, so everyone looked down on her. She is among the most vulnerable of her day. Naomi, however, wants to change this by providing for Ruth the one thing that will allow her to thrive in life. Now, in our culture, the one thing that allows people to thrive is an education. All right, so in the West, in Australia, if you want to be able to look after yourself, provide for yourself in Australia, you need a job. But in order to get a job, you need, for most jobs, basic reading, writing, and arithmetic. Right? People who don't have those things, they're behind the eight ball in Australian society, aren't they? And this is why a fair, this is why a fair and equitable education system must be a platform for any good government in the West, particularly in Australia. It is simply unjust to not provide people with the basic things they need to survive in life. And so in Australian society, that's an education. But in ancient cultures, the one thing that allowed people to thrive was having a family. Why? Because this was the age of subsistence farming, not big corporations. So if you wanted to survive back then, you couldn't go get a job at Woolies or at IBM, all right? You needed to get a spouse, and then you needed to have a whole bunch of kids so that they could help you work your field. Now, Ruth currently has none of that. She's got no field, she's got no kids, and she's got no husband. And so Naomi comes up with a plan to try and fix all of this. We see the plan in verse 2. "Now Boaz," she says, "with whose women you have worked, is a relative of ours." Boaz is the man of standing we saw in last week's passage, and Naomi sees him as good husband material. Now I pray that all the men are listening to this, whether you're single or married. If you want to be considered good husband material, then make sure you are a man of standing, a man of good reputation. Whether we like to think so or not, women don't want obnoxious, immature little brats as husbands. They want a man of standing. And so Naomi has her man of standing here, and she puts this plan into action, albeit with a bit of conniving, I mean, we have to admit, and we can see this in verse 3. Have a look. Naomi's still speaking. "Wash, put on perfume and get dressed in your blessed clothes, then go down to the threshing floor. But don't let him know that you're there until he's finished eating and drinking. When he lies down, note the place where he's lying, then go and uncover his feet and lie down. He will tell you what to do." So, 3 things that Naomi's telling Ruth to do here. Firstly, she's told to get herself dressed up. Now, I'm led to believe, though I'm not a woman, I'm led to believe that when women usually get dressed up, it's actually to impress other women. What a woman can and can't wear is one of those little ways that women like to compete with one another. Now, we men, we have our own feeble ways to compete with other guys, all right, like our muscles or our pay packet or our sporting prowess. We're no better, all right? But this is one of the ways women generally compete with other women. But this situation here is one of those rare occasions that a woman seems to be dressing up to impress a man. So that's step one. Step two, the second part of this scheme involves Ruth stepping into a realm where women weren't supposed to go. So we're told, we find out down in verse 14, that women were not supposed to be at the threshing floor. Now, the threshing floor was when you would take your grain, your wheat, and your barley, and you'd thresh it out. You'd get rid of the stalks, and you'd be left with just the grain. And we're led to believe that the men would often sleep at the threshing floor during harvest time, presumably to protect the grain either from the elements or from thieves. Finding a woman at the threshing floor at night would be like finding a woman in a male-only dorm room, right? You'd be asking, well, what's she doing here? Very suspicious, all right? And so this is why Ruth needs to sneak in under the cover of darkness. That's why she's told to note the place where Boaz lies down in verse 4, because she's going to have to go find him in the dark. Well, the third part of this cunning plan, we see, is to uncover Boaz's feet. Now, what's all that about? Well, we get a little help from Ezekiel 16:8. Let me read to you Ezekiel 16:8. Now, this is a verse in which God is speaking to Israel, and he says this to Israel. When I looked at you and saw that you were old enough for love, I spread the corner of my garment over you and covered your nakedness. I gave you my solemn oath and entered into a covenant with you, declares the sovereign Lord, and you became mine. So when Ruth asks Boaz to spread the corner of his garment over her in verse 9, what she's doing is she's proposing marriage. She's saying to Boaz, I want you to covenant yourself to me so that I can become yours. And if this plan goes well, Ruth will be a woman in need no longer. However, this is not a simple boy-meets-girl story. The reason being that Ruth has a problem, and the problem is that she is a widow, and in particular, a widow of a family that has no heir. So there are no men left in Elimelech's family to pass on the family name. And God had written a special law just about this very situation. Let me read to you Deuteronomy 25, verse 5. So this is from God's law. If brothers are living together and one of them dies without a son, his widow must not marry outside the family. Her husband's brother shall take her and marry her and fulfill the duty of a brother-in-law to her. Now, Ruth's brother-in-law died back in chapter 1. And that means that she now has to find the next nearest relative to marry. And this close relative is what's called a guardian redeemer. That's what it's called in verse 9. Now, in the Hebrew, it's the word goel. And a goel is usually your close or closest family member. And that closest family member is duty-bound, according to Deuteronomy 25:5, to marry a widow in his family. And this is what Boaz is getting at in verse 10. So have a look at verse 10. It's very strange, all right? The Lord bless you, my daughter, he replied. This kindness is greater than that which you showed earlier. You have not run after the young men, whether rich or poor. Now, I was trying to figure out, what is this kindness that Ruth is talking about, that Boaz is talking about here? I first thought it was simply because Boaz thought she was being kind in showing an interest in me. So whether you're a guy or a girl, it feels good when someone feels that you're worth it, right? But when I looked deeper into this, I realized that the kindness Boaz is referring to in verse 10 is the fact that Ruth is looking for a goel in verse 9. You see, Ruth could have gone and just found any young man who took her fancy and asked him to marry her. Yet the fact that she is looking for a goel means Ruth is following God's law from Deuteronomy 25:5 to the letter. She's following God's law to preserve Elimelech's family line. That's the kindness Boaz is talking about. The kindness of showing loyalty to her family through preserving Elimelech's line and showing loyalty to God's law. And Boaz says to himself, that's the kind of woman I want to marry. Look at verse 11. And now, my daughter, don't be afraid. I will do for you all that you ask. I pray that the women here are listening to this, whether you're married or single. Right? Your looks and your clothes and your perfume may make a good first impression on a guy. But the kind of women that men of standing are interested in are women who show this kind of godliness. All right, real beauty does not come from outward appearances. It comes from a godly heart. Well, in agreeing to be Ruth's goel, Boaz is also following God's law. That's what men of standing do. He's fulfilling his duty in Deuteronomy 25 to this widow of his extended family. Now, in verse 12, he does tell us there's another family member who is more closely related, as he says. And he says, if this other family member is not willing to be Ruth's goel, then he will do it. But here's the thing. What it entails, being a goel is enormous. And it's here that we really see just how incredible Boaz is. All right, there are four things that being a goel entails. The first is he has to get married, all right? That's the first thing. But the second thing is, it means buying back Elimelech's land. Now, we learn about this in chapter 4, but when Elimelech and Naomi left Israel back in chapter 1, they presumably sold their land. Yet, like the family line, preserving the family land was also important to God. In Leviticus 25, God said that family land cannot be sold permanently. God made a law that every 50 years, all right, that's the year of Jubilee, all land that has been bought or sold must be returned free of charge to the original owners. However, because 50 years is a long time, there were opportunities to have the land bought back, all right, redeemed by a goel, by a family redeemer, the nearest relative. And so Boaz is not just getting a wife here, he is taking on her debts as well. Right, he will have to buy back the family land. But it gets more complicated than that. You see, the main part of being a goel is to carry on the name of the deceased. So in Deuteronomy 25:5, we saw that the goel is to fulfill the role, that his duty to the deceased. The very next verse says this, all right, the first son she bears shall carry on the name of the dead brother so that his name will not be blotted out for Israel. So Boaz is not just agreeing to marriage, he's not just agreeing to take on her debts, he's also agreeing to have a child that will not be called by his name. Now, that's big for today's society. Imagine how big it was for a society that held preserving the family line of such importance that God wrote a law about it. Yet it gets even more complicated than that. For Ruth is a Moabite, and God wrote a law about them as well. Read it with me. No Ammonite or Moabite or any of his descendants may enter the assembly of the Lord, even down to the 10th generation. Yet Boaz says, I will redeem. I will marry this widow. I will take on all her debts. I will raise up a child that will take on someone else's name. And all my children will be half Moabite, half enemy. Friends, what kind of a person would do this? What kind of a person would give their whole life, their marriage, their children, their estate in order to redeem a woman in need. Well, it's actually the same principle we saw last week. The kind of person that would do this is someone who realizes he is not the real redeemer. God is. Now, yes, Boaz is the immediate redeemer, a close family member, but a person can only go to these extraordinary lengths if their heart has been shaped by the real redeemer. And the book of Ruth ends by pointing to who the real redeemer is. All right, so when Ruth and Boaz do actually finally get married, spoiler alert for next week, sorry, the name of their first son is Obed. Let me read to you the last two verses of the book of Ruth. So you can flick over a page or two. So Ruth chapter 4, verses 21, we get the genealogy here. Verse 21, Salmon, the father of Boaz, Boaz, the father of Obed, Obed, the father of Jesse, and Jesse, the father of David. Now, the fascinating thing about the book of Ruth is that even though Boaz's first son, Obed, was to carry on the name of Ruth's first husband, we're not told who Ruth's first husband was. Now, I think the author does this on purpose, but we have no idea whether Ruth was married to Mahlon or Chilion in chapter 1. We're not told. And so for all future generations, Obed was known as the son of Boaz. And Obed is no ordinary child. He's the grandfather of King David. And David is the great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather of King Jesus. And when we come to the New Testament, we note that David, Obed, Boaz, and Ruth all make it into the genealogy of Jesus, Matthew chapter 1. As our regulars will know, Jesus is the real redeemer that the book of Ruth points to. You see, like Ruth, Jesus left his father above. And like Ruth, he became an alien, a cosmic alien on earth. But even better than that, like Boaz, Jesus paid the debts for those he reached out to. And even better than that, Jesus reached out to people to connect with us, to covenant himself with us, so that we could become his. See, the cross is Jesus spreading his garment over you and I. He's becoming our Goel. And when we let him do that, when we say, spread the corner of your garment over me, Jesus, like Ruth, we no longer are a person in need. All right? We become covenanted to the greatest spouse in existence, a perfect spouse. All our debts, our sins are paid for. And we are given an estate, an inheritance, guaranteed for all eternity. Friends, it is Jesus, the real Redeemer, who actually empowers Christians to then do the same for others, to give up any and every aspect of our lives in order to help others. Now, what could that look like? Let me give us just three examples, all right? Three ways in which we can sacrifice, if I can use that word, elements of our lives in order to redeem others. So here's one. We could sacrifice our marriage. Now, I don't mean give up our marriage. You know what I mean when I say sacrifice, in inverted commas. We could sacrifice our marriage by allowing someone in need to come and live with us for a while. That's hard, having a stranger in your house. But we could redeem that person for a time. We could sacrifice our kids by not sending them to private school, rather sending them to a state school. You see, the problem with all the rich people taking their kids, their smart kids, out of the state system is the state system is left with the kids that are really struggling. And it actually becomes an inequitable education system. Are you willing to sacrifice your kids for the sake of others? Or we could sacrifice our estate. How do we do that? By adopting. Adopting kids who, for one reason or another, cannot live with their birth family. It's hard, isn't it? What would cause a person to be able to do that? The way we do that is by looking to Jesus as our Redeemer, not our example. Now, we can look to Jesus as an example. He's an awesome example. So is Boaz. But if we only look to them as our example, that will only get us over the line for a day or a week, or if you're lucky, a month. But sooner or later, redeeming people will become a burden to us. If we want to be able to redeem people like Boaz, give up everything, then we need to realize we're not the real Redeemer. Friends, I pray that we will not leave here today saying, I'm going to be like the man Boaz. My prayer is that we will leave here today saying, there was another man who left his father above, who became a cosmic alien. And he did so to reach out and covenant himself to me, to pay for all my debts, and to give me an inheritance, an estate that will never perish, spoil, or fade. Friends, I pray that we will leave here today saying Jesus died to be my Goel, my guardian redeemer. And the reason that's my prayer is that that is what will empower us to actually be like Boaz, to actually do those things, crazy things. Because you see, if Jesus is just our example, then we won't have the joy to keep pushing. Christ-like redemption will become a burden sooner or later. But even worse than that is we won't have the peace when we fail. Yet if Jesus is our real Redeemer, our Goel, we have perfect peace when we fail. Because we know Jesus has taken all that debt, all that sin away already. But even better than that is that we will want to succeed in this. We will see anyone as worthy of our efforts, because we know that's what Jesus did for us, only 1,000 times better. So friends, may Jesus continue to be our real Redeemer, so that we can be the immediate Redeemer to any who cross our path.